Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Neuroendocrine Tumors. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Pamela Coons from the Yale School of Medicine. In addition to this interview program, there's also a corresponding presentation featuring Dr. Coons' slides. To begin, I asked her to comment on one of the points she made in her presentation about the increasing incidence of neuroendocrine tumors.
Let me just begin by asking you, one of the things I thought was interesting, when in the beginning you pointed out the increasing incidence of these lesions. What's the theory behind why that is? Could it be more diagnosis, or is it really increasing?
You know, I think it's probably a combination, Neil. So I think that was over about a 30 to 40 year period. And I think in that time, we have seen definite improvements in diagnosis. So we see incidentally discovered rectal neuroendocrine tumors. That's actually one of the highest incident. And that's because patients are getting more colonoscopies. Our imaging tools are better. So we actually pick up a number of incidental nets based on imaging for other reasons. And then our pathology is getting better. So I think we're just recognizing them more. But it is believed that it is not enough to explain the incidence. So then over that period of time, which is fairly short, there are likely some environmental causes that we're seeing, but I think it's just not been, we don't know the exact answers yet, but probably a combination.
I assume the mortality has been staying the same?
I think the mortality has actually been improving. And I think some of that is because really what I didn't show you, I have a great timeline of FDA approvals, and they've really just been in the last decade. So our FDA approvals really started in 2011 with everolimus and sunitinib, and prior to that, the last FDA approval prior to 2011 was in the 1980s with octreotide. We've seen so many advances in treatment. We have seen improvements in overall survival.
Another thing I was going to ask you about is you mentioned periprocedural treatments. So can you talk a little bit more about that? And do you treat these patients even if they're asymptomatic? And also you referred to carcinoid crisis. Like, what is that?
Yeah. So we would put this in the category really of functional NETs. So for patients with true carcinoid syndrome, which is again only about 10% of patients with small intestine NETs, they can also be at risk for something called carcinoid crisis. Carcinoid crisis can happen at times of stress. So that can include like a surgical stress, but it can include other causes of stress. And carcinoid crisis includes hemodynamic instability. So blood pressure fluctuations, significantly low blood pressure or significantly high blood pressure. And the right choice on a multiple choice test would be to give a dose of IV octreotide. It's usually 250 to 500 micrograms times one. It's a bolus given preoperatively or prior to a procedure. But I will say this has been studied some, and it's really up for debate as to how much that really reduces the risk of carcinoid crisis.
And then another question I have is age of diagnosis. What do you see there?
The median age is usually in the 60s, so it is definitely a disease of older adults. But we see a huge range, and I would say specifically, you know, about 5% of patients with NETs have NETs because of an inherited syndrome like multiple endocrine neoplasia, von Hippel-Lindau that I mentioned, neurofibromatosis. Those patients will often get diagnosed at an earlier age.
And also, just to clarify about von Hippel-Lindau and about belzutifan, the data you were showing, those are VHL patients, not sporadic, correct?
You are exactly right. So
go ahead. So I just wondered, is there any activity in sporadic, as there is, I think, in renal?
So that's an excellent question. I don't think it's been studied in sporadic patients. So certainly a great research question. That particular study was patients only with von Hippel-Lindau, and they had to have had either a proven, like that table that I showed on the right of that slide, were proven pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors or pancreatic lesions that I think were presumably neuroendocrine tumors but had not been biopsied.
I don't really understand actually why it works in sporadic renal, do you?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I mean, okay, let's...
It's hard to, in terms of the biology, you know, it's a HIF-2 alpha inhibitor. I think we'd have to look at sort of whether that plays a role in sporadic. I don't know the answer to that, though.
All right, let's get into your cases, starting out with this 50-year-old woman. What happened with her?
Sure. So this is a 50-year-old woman. She has a newly diagnosed metastatic, non-functional, well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor. It's a grade 1. Ki-67 is 1%, and it's of a small bowel primary. She has pretty low-volume liver metastatic disease, and it was actually found incidentally at the time of a hysterectomy. And the small bowel primary tumor was surgically removed. I'll maybe just... kind of mention something about that. We will sometimes try to remove primary small bowel tumors, even when patients have metastatic disease, in an effort to try to prevent bowel obstruction later on. Small bowel nets can also cause fibrosis of the mesentery, and that can create really bad plumbing problems if you get sort of scarred and fibrotic small bowel. So that's why that was done. So the question is, what is the next best step? So she's had the small bowel primary tumor removed, but nothing else. Observation, somatostatin analog, lutetium dotatate, capecitabine temozolomide, or liver-directed therapy. The two figures I've shown you, one is a cross-sectional imaging using an MRI abdomen through the liver. You can see the hypodense liver lesions. And then also we see the gallium-68 dotatate PET CT with a number of lesions in the liver on the left. Just for purposes of explaining this, the spleen is always bright. And because the gallium-68 is cleared through the GU system, we see that the kidneys are a little bit bright and there's some collection in the bladder.
What do you typically do in terms of workup in addition to the imaging? Anything else that you do in a situation like this?
Well, so I typically, especially for small bowel, I always get a 24-hour urine 5-HIA, even if they are not especially symptomatic. I think that's important to do. Sometimes patients can have low-level elevations or be asymptomatic, but it's important for us to know because it does have some downstream consequences of how we monitor their heart. We would typically, if they have an elevated 5-HIA, get heart ultrasounds to monitor for cardiac valvular fibrosis. Basic labs, so CBC, CMP. I get often asked if I check chromogranin A. Chromogranin is a tumor marker. It is not a hormone. I would say that the field in general has really swung away from checking that routinely. It fluctuates significantly and I think causes more anxiety for patients and providers than it is helpful. So I am generally not checking chromogranin A anymore.
I'm also just kind of thinking in general, as you get into these cases, just even starting with this one, you would think this is a rare enough and complicated enough situation that it'd be helpful to have input from somebody like you or other people involved with clinical research. But a lot of times that's a little bit complicated in terms of travel. Have there been any attempts to try to kind of bring in, you know, virtual second opinions in general, or even email kind of consultations? It seems kind of challenging, even though you say there's a lot of, you know, prevalence, is still this kind of decision is not made very often by oncologists.
Yeah, Neil, that's a great point. We generally advocate, we sort of the NET professional societies generally advocate that patients do get connected with a NET expert. For example, I partner a lot with community oncologists, and I think that's really the best of both worlds for patients because they get the convenience of care closer to home, but they get some input from an expert. And that can be done in a number of ways. So that can be done through in-person consultations, but there are a number of ways that many institutions now do provide virtual consultations, whether they be just a written recommendation or whether they be formal video visit consultations. So I think one of the silver linings of the pandemic is that did teach us we can do telehealth. And so I would recommend certainly that patients with rare cancers, NETs is one example, but do get connected with an expert.
So this was your patient? You took care of her?
It is indeed my patient, yes. I think there are really two options here, and I know I'm not supposed to have more than one correct choice, but I think that observation or somatostatin analog are actually very reasonable for this patient. And I think I want to just acknowledge, though, it's really hard to meet a new patient and say you have a newly diagnosed metastatic cancer and we're going to recommend observation. So I think that it really requires a thoughtful, informed decision making between the physician and the patient about what's the best fit for that patient. I think I tell patients that if you are going to sit home and worry, then observation is not going to be right for you. Then let's start something, whether it's octreotide or lanreotide. I'll remind you of that CLARINET progression-free survival curve where the placebo median progression-free survival was 18 months. If I can spare a patient 18 months of getting in a monthly shot, I actually think there's some benefit to that. So I think that it really requires having that conversation.
Yeah, and I just flashed, we're doing a webinar tomorrow night on CLL. Of course, every single one of those cases starts out, oh, they got blood count and we're observed, so it's not unique to oncology, but that's why I was asking you whether she was your patient, because 50-year-old woman being told she has metastatic disease to the liver is kind of scary. What was her life situation and how did she respond to that?
So I think it was really scary for her initially. And I think I've now been taking care of her for quite a while. And it's, you know, I think that it's, when I meet a new patient with a low-grade neuroendocrine tumor, I think the best thing I can do for them is talk to them about how this is a chronic cancer. They're very different than other cancer types. I like to think that we can treat this like we would diabetes or high blood pressure. They may live for years, if not decades. And we have many tools now in our toolkit, which is actually having been part of this field for that decade where we've seen all of these FDA approvals is just, I think, really hopeful. And patients that I've personally taken care of have lived through seeing some of these new FDA approvals. So I think it's really, really balancing, you know, this sense of hope with this particular field and the fact that she can do well for a long time. But also explaining, you know, what the imaging means and what it would mean to be on observation versus an SSA. So it requires, I think, that upfront investment in education, which I think is really critical to that, you know, the patient-doctor relationship.
I'm curious how often patients bring up Steve Jobs and how you respond when they do bring it up.
So, I mean, I would say when I was in Silicon Valley and practicing at Stanford, that came up a little bit more often. less so in New Haven, Connecticut. But I mean, it certainly comes up. And I think even when patients bring up, you know, their aunt had some other cancer type, I just really caution patients against comparing themselves with another friend, family, celebrity. Every case is very different, and I try to help them focus on what's in front of them.
Just out of curiosity, just thinking about that prevalence rate that you were talking about, are there advocacy groups for this?
Yes, this is actually a really active area of advocacy. And I think you can imagine that because patients live for so long, they learn to become their own experts, which I actually love and can be really empowering for patients. So there are a lot of advocacy groups. And I'm sure, as you know, Neil, most of our professional societies and I'm the chair of the National Cancer Institute Task Force for Neuroendocrine Tumors. We have patient advocates on our task forces. It's a really critical role because I think having the patient voice in design of clinical trials or in how we deliver care for patients with NETs is really important.
So you mentioned cardiac issues, and you saw that picture of the valve there. And I'm curious, how often do you, is this actually clinically relevant? When you do autopsies, do you see a lot more than becomes clinically relevant? And in particular, do any of the interventions prevent it?
Yeah, all really good questions. So I think that the cardiac valvular fibrosis happens in patients with true carcinoid syndrome. So those would be with elevated 5-HIA. We know that that can cause fibrosis. Does not happen in all patients with carcinoid syndrome. It's probably less than half, but it's probably more than was previously appreciated. So I don't know the data on autopsy series, Neil, but that's a great question. But I think I would, you know, imagine that it's certainly higher than what becomes clinically pertinent or clinically noticeable. So what we do for these patients is if we notice that they have an elevated 5-HIA, we get a baseline echocardiogram and we get an echocardiogram every 2 to 3 years. If a patient, in fact, does have cardiac valvular fibrosis, I connect them with my cardio-oncology team and they co-follow the patient with me, and then they're getting annual echocardiograms. I've certainly had patients over my time, as this is their presenting symptom, they present with heart failure and lo and behold, they have valvular disease and they have a neuroendocrine tumor. That happens infrequently, but that can happen.
I'm trying to remember, which is it, all the cardiac valves or
no, it's the right-sided valves. Yep, right-sided valves.
Right. And a little bit more in terms of this patient, her life situation. Did she have a family? Was she working?
So working, has a family, has been able to work. And I think that's also the key, is that she was asymptomatic. This was found incidentally. I think when I talk to patients that feel well, they, you know, they're like, gosh, how could I be diagnosed with metastatic disease? I feel great. And my goal is to help them keep feeling well. And often that also comes down to this decision of observation versus an injection. Now, octreotide and lanreotide are very well tolerated among, you know, the agents that cause the least amount of side effects in the world of oncology. But they're not without side effect. They're an injection into the buttock muscle that can cause some injection site pain. And there are some other side effects that can happen. And so I tell patients, I certainly don't want the fix to be worse than the problem. So as we are selecting treatments, the side effects that come from the treatments also weigh into our decision making.
So I'm just going to take a guess and say, she asked you, what would you do if it were you? And you said, I would be observed, and that's what she did.
That's right. That's right.
So, did she ask you that incidentally?
Then, you know, some patients do. I give them permission. I mean, I think in that initial conversation, I can get a pretty good sense if someone's going to be really nervous with the observation approach. And if that's the case, I give them permission to do octreotide or lanreotide. So I try to really listen to them. And at time of next progression, I sort of set them up and say, well, we have our next step already lined up, and we would consider octreotide or lanreotide when you progress.
So yeah. In this particular situation,
I
just want to ask you, in this particular situation, if she had elected to go with an SSA, which one would you have used?
You're going to pin me down on that. So good question. You know, I think that the lanreotide data are, again, more modern, rigorous clinical trial data. And it was conducted certainly more recently than the PROMID clinical trial, I should say. But I'd be hard-pressed. So I think it depends really on availability at your institution, your familiarity with giving it. There are, you know, we would ask, well, gosh, if they're equivalent, is there patient quality of life or patient reported outcome differences in these two? And there have been some mixed reports on those in terms of Some studies have shown there's no difference in terms of patient-reported outcomes between receiving octreotide or lanreotide. And then some studies have shown that there may be less site injection pain with lanreotide. It's sub-Q versus IM. So I'm a little hard-pressed now, specifically for small bowel. Now, if you ask me for pancreas, the PROMID study didn't include pancreas patients and the lanreotide study did. So if you are a purist, you would say you would use lanreotide exclusively for pancreatic NETs. But again, mechanism of action is exactly the same.
Any difference in cost or out-of-pocket?
Not to my knowledge. They are both expensive. They are both generally required to be given by a nurse. Actually, what's interesting is that outside of the U.S., there can be some self-injection. And then during the COVID pandemic, we also had home visiting nurses administer some of these. So I think we're trying to learn a little bit more about, you know, methods and locations of administration to try to make it easier for patients.
And what's this patient's current situation?
She is doing well. So, I mean, I anticipate that she has many years ahead of her, and we have many subsequent therapy options, and she is doing well.
Any predictors of requirements for treatment? I just learned there's one for CLL that I want to learn more about. But are there any ways you can tell if the patient says to you, what's the likelihood that I'm going to require treatment or how long will it be? Are there any ways to give them an estimate?
Gosh, that is such a good question and such a gap in our field. We do not have good predictors of who's going to respond. I presented a little bit of the data on MGMT, so looking at responsiveness to temozolomide for pancreatic NETs. We're hoping that that story evolves, but we do not have great predictors. So case two, this is a 60-year-old man who has a five-year history of a metastatic, well-differentiated WHO grade 1, Ki-67 of 2%, small bowel NET with low volume liver metastases. The patient has been on octreotide since diagnosis with control of diarrhea and flushing and stable disease on scans, but recently the diarrhea has increased from 2 bowel movements per day to 6 bowel movements per day, but the disease remains stable. So on the right, you can see the MRI of the abdomen. It shows some low volume liver disease. Those are hypervascular lesions in the liver. So the questions are, what is the next best step? So patient is already on octreotide. So we gave that to you already. Would you add octreotide? Would you add telotrastat? Would you start lutetium dotatate, capecitabine temozolomide, or consider liver-directed therapy, either bland or chemoembolization? And, Neil, I might just make a comment on, because we're not going to do a liver-directed case, but I'll just make a comment on that. So as our audience knows, there are really three forms of liver-directed therapy: bland, chemoembolization, and radioembolization. In the field of NETs, radioembolization has really fallen out of favor in the era of PRRT because we don't generally want to, we wouldn't consider giving radioembolization prior to PRRT because you wouldn't want to double radiate the liver. And so that is really kind of, we've put that on the back burner nowadays. And if someone needs a liver-directed therapy to site or reduce, we would consider bland or chemoembolization prior to radioembolization.
So what did you elect to do or recommend to this patient?
So for this patient, we actually started telotrastat. The reason being, the scans were stable, so I didn't need a tumor control agent. I needed something to better control the patient's carcinoid syndrome diarrhea. So I'll remind everybody that the telotrastat at the 250 milligram TID dose on average reduced the number of bowel movements by 2 bowel movements a day in the clinical trial that led to its approval. So we are hoping I can't remember if that happened for this patient, but and telotrastat as an oral agent is like pretty easy for patients to take. It is TID, but it's oral, so not another injection. I think that So for A, if we were to consider like increasing the octreotide, sometimes we'll consider going from four times, like every 4 weeks to every 3 weeks, or maybe you would consider adding short-acting octreotide. So those are additional injections for the patient. And again, sometimes that comes down to patient preference. Some patients hate taking pills and others would, you know, really prefer an injection and vice versa. So again, it comes down to having that conversation with the patient.
Are there any supportive care measures that help with the diarrhea? I mean, loperamide, diet, anything that you recommend to your patients?
Yes, excellent question. And in fact, patients with neuroendocrine tumors and diarrhea, it's often multifactorial. So imagine a patient, so somatostatin analogs themselves can cause pancreatic enzyme deficiency. So they may need to be on Creon for that. Many of our patients have had prophylactic cholecystectomies because if they are getting an elective surgery, we will often remove their gallbladder because they can develop gallstones if they're on long-term somatostatin analogs. So they might have bile acid malabsorption. Many have had small bowel surgery, so they may have short gut. So you can imagine, Neil, it's really hard to tease out what the diarrhea is from. And so we really partner closely with gastroenterology colleagues. I actually have a list in my notes of, have they had a cholecystectomy? Are they on an SSA? Have they had bowel resection? Because it helps me remember what other tools and tricks. So I may put them on Creon or I may put them on a bile acid sequestrant. Yes to Imodium and Loperam, you know, and Lomotil. So we try to use all those tricks.
Interesting. So what happened with this man when he started on therapy?
He improved by 2 bowel movements per day. But I think I'll add one other thing to this is that on the clinical trial that led to telostrostat's approval, there was an observation that patients on telostrostat had stable disease. So there's really this question as it's not approved as an anti-tumor agent, but I think there's a lot of interest in studying it in that space. We don't know yet, but I think this patient went on to have stable disease for a while, and it's hard to know if it's the biology, if it's the octreotide, or if the telostrostat's helping at all.
What do you see in terms of side effects, if any, with telostrostat, and did this man have any issues?
This man did not have issues, so the telostrostat itself is very well tolerated. It can cause some constipation, I should say, which for many patients is actually a welcome break from the diarrhea that they're having. But we have to be really thoughtful about that. And that's why there's two dose options. So there's the 250 TID and the 500 TID. So if patients are having not quite achieving the bowel movement reduction, we can go up to 500 TID. But if they develop more constipation or more symptoms at that dose, we can go back down.
In general, how would you say this man's quality of life has been? I mean, he's had metastatic disease for more than 5 years. Has he been able to live a normal lifestyle? Is he working?
Yes, and I think that that's really an important takeaway with these patients with metastatic NETs is that, again, we really like a key takeaway for them, especially in the beginning when they're diagnosed, to be that this is a chronic disease, a chronic cancer that we hope to allow them to live as well as they can for as long as they can. So for a metastatic small bowel NET, patients can really live for a long time and be on a somatostatin analog for quite a long time before needing other therapies. So yes, so he's working and has good quality of life, especially with the bowel movement reduction.
All right, let's go to your last case.
Excellent. Okay, last case. This is a 60-year-old, otherwise healthy man with a 2-month history of left lower quadrant cramping, GI upset, low appetite, and a 5-pound weight loss. A CT scan showed a hypervascular pancreatic mass and I would say pretty bulky liver lesions. The liver biopsy showed a well-differentiated WHO grade 2 Ki-67 3% NET. So you can see, I put in two pictures here that show both the pancreatic lesion that's kind of near the spleen, that's in the picture along the bottom, with hypervascular liver lesions in both of the cross sections. I'll mention a pretty key takeaway, though this is an MRI. The mainstay of monitoring patients on NETs is with either an MRI or a CT scan with contrast. The DOTA PETs we typically do at diagnosis, at times that questions arise, or every couple years, but they're not the main tool that we image patients. If you order a CT scan for patients and I did mention in the little bio that he got a CT initially, but we switched to MRI because the liver lesions were better seen. A CT scan has to be done with an arterial phase to really best be able to appreciate the liver lesions, because otherwise they can really be missed. And we just had a hard time seeing his liver lesions on CT, so we switched. So what's the best first-line treatment? So I've intentionally listed a lot of the same treatments in our other cases, but I think I added another one. So SSA for him, would you give ludotatate, capecitabine temozolomide, carboplatin etoposide, or liver-directed therapy?
So can you follow up with what happened?
Yes. So, we gave him capecitabine temozolomide, and I'll tell you why. So I was worried he was symptomatic. He had bulky disease. I felt that a primary goal of treatment for him was objective response. Like, I needed his lesions to shrink in order for him to feel better. Starting off with bulky disease in the liver, I knew that the liver and liver failure would be a real potential future problem for him. So if I can get tumor shrinkage early, that's going to make me feel better. And then I consider some of these other therapies. And if you remember from the ECOG 2211 study, the objective response rate for the combination arm was 40%. So we had a pretty good chance of achieving tumor shrinkage. Capecitabine temozolomide is actually very well tolerated. I'm sure most of our audience is familiar, but the dosing schedule for this is given capecitabine BID for 14 days. The temozolomide is given days 10 through 14, so just 5 days of overlap with the cape, and then 2 weeks off. So really 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. And we see, standard side effects, but we don't see lots of prolonged cytopenias with some of the alternate dosing that is sometimes used with glioblastoma.
You, in the beginning of your talk, you went through a really great graphic in terms of the key things that you look at when you see a patient: hormone status, stage of burden of disease, grade and differentiation, mm-hmm. pace of growth, primary site, SSTR status. How did this patient fit into that sort of model?
Yeah. So, the thing that I was reassuring was the fact that it was relatively low grade. That Ki-67 is on a scale of 1 to 100. It just barely went over into the grade 2, which is between 3 and 20. So that's favorable. But what I was worried about was it being a bulky tumor and the fact that he was symptomatic, very likely from the tumor bulk. Lower quadrant cramping, GI upset, low appetite, weight loss. So I think what really... So you could have selected a somatostatin analog, but SSAs do not yield tumor shrinkage. So I think that wasn't going to necessarily help him feel better. It would have maybe stabilized growth. Lutetium dotatate at present is only FDA approved in the second line setting after progression on a somatostatin analog. It's being studied in the first line setting. There's actually a new clinical trial that just finished accruing called NETTER-2 that's looking at ludotatate versus octreotide in the first line setting. So I think it was really what drove me to, and then the primary site. So capecitabine temozolomide, generally we reserve that for pancreatic NETs. So if you have a patient with a pancreatic NET for whom you're worried about like bulky tumors that are causing symptoms, capecitabine temozolomide is really the way to go.
I'm curious how many patients you've treated with belzutifan.
Zero.
Really?
So far. VHL is really rare. So, in my lifetime, I only see NETs. I think I've taken care of one or two patients with von Hippel-Lindau. So it's just, it's not super common.
I wonder, you know, if the renal, I guess it's the renal people who usually see those patients. I guess if they were to see Annette, they would probably bring in a consultant, I would assume, in that situation. But yeah, I can, so that's interesting. Yep. You haven't used it. What's the follow-up?
Not yet.
With this case?
I'm looking for it. So this patient, I'm not showing the scans here, but has had his first set of scans after 3 months of capecitabine temozolomide and has had almost a 50% response. So really, really nice response rate. So feels better, which is great.
Any toxicity with the treatment?
A little bit of cytopenia is something that we can see. This patient has experienced a little bit of that. But, you know, we do some dose reductions and carry on.
So I see that you have the slide after this kind of with some conclusions. Maybe you can sort of review that and we'll kind of bring this to a close.
Yeah, sure. I think that, you know, I hoped I, with some of the epidemiologic studies, shared that NETs are really not that rare. And I think what we've seen over the last decade is that they are deserving of high quality basic translational and clinical research efforts. We've seen just an explosion of advances in the last decade, which has been really exciting to be part of. With many tools, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, mTOR inhibitors, cytotoxic chemo, lutetium dotatate as the kind of first form of FDA-approved PRRT, liver-directed therapy. PRRT, I think if I'm asked what I'm most excited about in the future, I think PRRT is a game changer. We really hope to optimize its use through future studies. So how can we better select patients? You asked about that, Neil. Minimizing toxicities, can we increase efficacy by combining it with other agents? And another topic we touched on today was expert care, multidisciplinary care for patients with NETs is also critical with surgeonc, endocrine, cardiology. You know, we mentioned actually a lot of those specialists today in the course of conversation.
One final question. I'm just kind of curious how you ended up getting involved with this. What was it that led you to do it? I hear all kinds of stories from people. I'm curious what yours is.
Yeah, great question. So I was interested broadly in GI oncology because I really liked the breadth of diseases. I liked being able to take care of male and female patients, a range of ages. And then I had a mentor say to me, it's a lot easier to become an expert in a rare disease. So at the time, the bar was low. I was finishing fellowship in 2008. This was pre that, you know, big rush of FDA approvals. So I wrote a review paper on neuroendocrine tumors, got connected with a number of mentors in the field of, you know, really, I'd say many outside of my home institution and have really connected with this village and community. And, I think what really resonates with me and I get a lot of real satisfaction out of is being an expert in a rare disease. I think I can really educate patients. I can contribute to research where little is known. And I think by nature, I like knowing a lot about a really narrow space. So it's been a good fit for me.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Koons, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Lowe for Oncology Today.